This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in this week for Tanzina Vega.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted.
This is a good plan that provides direct assistance to the people of this country.
We are going to be saddled with a burden, a spending burden, and a tax burden that is really indefensible from the perspective of what it actually accomplishes.
Legislation represents the boldest action taken on behalf of the American people since the Great Depression.
And outside of stimulus payments, nearly half won't even be spent this year. It is simply unfathomable that Democrats want to spend money years down the road.
The American Rescue Plan is transformative. It will comprehensively and compassionately meet the moment.
On Wednesday, the House of Representatives passed a hard-won $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. All but one Democrat voted for the bill. Jared Golden of Maine was the lone no, and every Republican voted against it. The bill, known as the American Rescue Plan, includes $1,400 checks for families, extends unemployment insurance, and provides funding for vaccine distribution. One aspect of the bill that has gotten less attention so far is $10.4 billion that will go towards agriculture. Approximately $5 billion of that will go towards disadvantaged farmers, many of whom are Black. Here to explain the significance of this legislation and some of the history behind the struggles that Black farmers have been facing for decades is Lloyd Wright, a farmer from Westmoreland County, Virginia, and former director of the USDA Civil Rights Office. Lloyd, welcome to The Takeaway.
How you doing? Great.
Also with us today is Laura Riley, Business of Food reporter for The Washington Post. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Laura, how and why did this aid to disadvantaged farmers in particular become part of the overall COVID stimulus package?
So this is correcting historic problems. So in November, Cory Booker introduced the Justice for Black Farmers Act, and that got revised a little bit and then taken up by Senator Warnock as the Emergency Relief for Farmers of Color Act. And it was that piece of legislation that was the model for what ended up in this relief bill.
And Lloyd, this bill is huge for Black farmers specifically. Can you explain why and how this in particular helps them?
Black farmers in general consider this to be probably the most significant act since this 1964 Civil Rights Act, in that, you know, whereas Black farmers have always been discriminated against by the Department of Ag, efforts to correct it in the past really didn't work. Pigfoot, for example, promised debt relief, but farmers didn't get it, and many of them are still going out of business. So we're convinced that if this act is implemented the way we think it should be, and that is that the Black farmers will get debt relief, we will save the few remaining Black farms in this country.
Debt relief, is that the big provision in here that's going to be so helpful for Black farmers?
Yes, it's the debt relief. And that, just for a little background, in the Pigfoot lawsuit, Black farmers thought they were going to get compensation, debt relief, and priority for future programs. They really received $50,000, those who prevailed. Only 371 got debt relief, and some of them stopped making payments because they were told that the debt would be forgiven. And when Pigfoot was over, 4 or 5 years down the road, they learned they were not going to get debt relief. Some of them were in debt with interest and penalties that they still haven't climbed out of. In fact, Pigfoot probably put more farmers out of business than it helped. So we think this is really the first relief that's going to try to save the remaining Black farmers.
Huh. Laura, the American Rescue Plan allocates something like $4 billion for disadvantaged farmers, about a quarter of whom are Black. Can you talk a little bit more about what this relief looks like? We talked about debt relief. What are some of the other elements of this?
Well, so it's $5 billion. And $4 billion of that is in direct debt relief, as Mr. Wright just said. $1 billion is for grants, outreach, and other programs that are really aimed at recouping lost land. So Black farmers have lost something like 15 million acres over the past 100 years, you know, largely since the 1950s. And through a number of legal and quasi-legal mechanisms. You know, a lot of times they've lost land due to foreclosure. They've lost land because they don't have clear title. And often they've lost land because of something called heirs property, which is when a Black farmer dies without a will, all of his property essentially gets chopped up between all legal heirs. And that is a way that kind of unscrupulous, real estate folks have chiseled away at that farmland over generations.
Laura, why have Black farmers fallen victim to some of these systemic issues more so than white farmers?
Well, there's been kind of systemic racism at the USDA, largely at the local level. So a farmer will go into his local USDA office and get in line for the various programs that they offer, including loans. And often they get their loans late. So the loans that they need for seed or fertilizer or to repair equipment, or they get a lesser loan, or they don't get a loan at all. And really, I think what people who are not in farming don't understand is that almost all farmers get annual loans in order to buy the stuff they need to plant. And then they repay those loans at the end of the growing season once they have what they harvest. So the whole system is really predicated on these kind of short-term loans, in addition to real estate loans for your land itself. And if systematically those Black farmers are last in line to get these loans, it means they plant late, which means their yield is worse. So it's this kind of cycle that they can't get out of.
Lloyd, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham called the allocation of stimulus funds for disadvantaged farmers reparations. He intended it to be a disparaging comment, but then advocates for Black farmers have approvingly called this reparations. Do you see this in any way as a form of reparations?
No, I do not. In that, if they were trying to give farmers back the land that they've lost over years, if they were trying to compensate farmers and their families for all of the pain that the USDA has inflicted, catch up with the education system, you know, et cetera, maybe that would be reparations. This is really providing farmers with something they should have had 25 years ago. They've been promised a lot of things in the past they never received. So certainly I wouldn't call it reparations. You'd have to do a lot more than this. Although this is excellent, I don't want to downplay that.
Sure.
But you need to go beyond what's in this bill. The Justice for Black Farmer Act might get closer. There's some additional provisions in that.
What is that bill? What does that bill do?
Well, actually, that bill would provide up to 160 acres of land to some farmers, Black farmers. It would do a catch-up program, as stated, we didn't get, Blacks didn't get services. Well, one of the problems in the past has been USDA is probably the only agency that allow local control. In other words, the county committees are selected by farmers who are getting the benefits. They're the only ones who can vote. And then they weigh in on who can get what. And back when I was director of civil rights, 95% of the county committeemen were white males. They took care of themselves, their family, and their friends, and people of color didn't get very much. So It's been a long, long time of local control and denying farmers what they should have had. And so hopefully that will get addressed down the road, and the Justice for Black Farmer Act hopefully will address that as well. We need to really weigh in on that system of allowing the local control. So there's a number of good things. It'll also straighten out the Office of Civil Rights that's dysfunctional.
Laura, you reported that Black farmers have lost 12 million acres of land since the 50s due to systemic racism and biased government policy. Does this latest round of funds ultimately help Black farmers acquire more land and maybe acquire some of that land back, so to speak? Or does it just stop the bleeding in terms of the lost acreage?
I'm pretty hopeful that it will restore some land. So the average Black farmer has 100 acres. The national average is 440 acres. 98% of farmland is owned by white farmers. And, you know, we've had this kind of ethos in the United States for decades, kind of, you know, get big or get out. You know, the only way to really make money farming, whether you're farming row crops or ranching or, you know, growing specialty crops, you know, fruit and veg, the only way to be successful at it is to do it at scale. And that's been problematic for a very long time. You know, we also have an aging farmer situation right now, and the average farmer ages 50. So we're really at a moment, an inflection point, where there's going to be a lot of turnover. And so I'm hopeful that some of this money, and especially the outreach programs that will assist land grant universities and historically Black colleges to focus on the needs and goals of Black farmers, I'm hopeful that that will change.
Laura, can you explain one thing to me? Much of the money is earmarked for socially disadvantaged farmers. Are those specifically Black farmers? Are other farmers included in that category?
Yes. So Indigenous, Native American farmers who have also been discriminated against and also had lost a lot of land, they are in this. All farmers of color, but the Black farmers have had a specific and longstanding issue with how they are treated by local banks, by the USDA, et cetera. So I think that their situation demands more direct compensation.
Recently, during the Trump administration, there were bailouts for farmers who were affected by the trade war with China. Laura, what do we know about how much of that money, I think it was $28 billion, went to Black farmers?
Very little. And, you know, I had pushback on the story I wrote earlier this week from farmers in the Midwest saying, hey, you know, the bailout went largely to people who had their trade partner in China, you know, temporarily disrupted because of these trade wars, or pork producers, because pork, you know, we had a unique opportunity last year because China had lost half of its pork herd because of African swine fever. So pork producers in the U.S. were like, woohoo, this is our opportunity, our golden opportunity to sell massive amounts of pork into China. And the trade war disrupted that. So a lot of the producers of the things I just mentioned are white. And so they, in fact, were the ones who received this $28 billion in relief. However, if you look at the money that has gone, the pandemic, the CFAP, TFAP, all those programs, they too have largely benefited white farmers.
Lloyd, I'm going to let you get back to the farm in a moment, but you and your father, who is also a farmer, have experienced some of the racism that we've been talking about firsthand. Can you just describe a bit for our listeners what it's like to be a Black farmer in America?
Well, it's almost like, you know, fighting with one hand tied behind your back. And farming is difficult, and a number of farmers will go out of business for various reasons, you know, weather, disaster, you name it. But if you really are handicapped from the beginning by the Department of Agriculture, it's really difficult. And I think, you know, I'll give you an example with my father, who at the end would not work with USDA. He had two tracts, which mean two deeded pieces of property on different tracts. And he had an allocation for wheat. And the office told him he could put it all on either tract, the whole allotment. And he did. And then before he harvested, another person came out doing spot check and said, no, you can only put the amount allocated to each tract. And he had put most of the wheat on the small tract, and he had to destroy 3/4 of the wheat. And disregarding the fact that they told him to do it, they made him destroy it. It was those kinds of things where they tell you to do something, then come back and punish you for having carried out the order. And that's what happened. One thing with my father, you know, another, when we had a disaster in 72 from a hurricane where the oysters, because my father also was an oyster farmer, and we still operate the oyster beds. He was supposed to get some money to try to reestablish after the oysters was killed from the fresh water. They use language that, and would not write on a piece of paper the one item they wanted. And I was upstate New York at the time. I had to come home to find out really what they needed, because the deadline was approaching. And all they needed was the deed showing that he actually had the lease to this oyster bed. And it took me less than a couple hours to do it. But for blacks who didn't have someone to come home and do that for them, they didn't get it at all. So it's those kinds of little tricky things they do. Some things worse, like giving loans late. That's true. And then they also supervise the loans. So even though you have a loan, the county committee or the county office will tell you when and what you can buy. So it's those kind of things that really has hurt black farmers. And hopefully the Justice for Black Farmer Act will get in some detail and address those things. But yes, my father was discriminated, and he never complained. And that's the other thing. There are probably more farmers discriminated against who didn't complain than did. So the good thing I like about this Emergency Act is that it doesn't rely on a foul complaint. Because many farmers, just to survive in the community, refuse to complain even though they've been discriminated against.
Lloyd Wright is a farmer and former director of the USDA Civil Rights Office. And Laura Riley is a business of food reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you both for explaining this issue and these challenges to us.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be on with Mr. Wright.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, and I'm always pleased to read your articles.
This latest funding is just a drop in the bucket when taken in the context of decades of discrimination against black farmers who faced hurdles in securing loans from the USDA. 100 years ago, there were around 1 million black farmers in the U.S. Today, there are less than 50,000. Here to provide us with some historical context is Nadra Niddle, senior reporter for Civil Eats and a contributor to Eater. Nadra, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Can you give us an overview of the difficult history between the U.S. Department of Agriculture and black farmers?
Yes, it goes back, you know, at least a century. And much of the problem is related to loans and the fact that African-American farmers who applied for loans from the USDA were routinely denied them and other forms of technical assistance and support that they needed to thrive in the agriculture industry.
What does that mean for farmers? Like, what are the prospects like for farmers who aren't able to secure these federal loans from the USDA?
Well, the farmers who weren't able to secure loans were prevented from doing things like buying the equipment that they needed to improve their farms, to expand the size of their farms, and to compete with white farmers who typically have larger farms, up to quadruple the size of black-owned farms. So these policies effectively, you know, prevented African Americans from having a level playing field in agriculture.
So what kind of tangible losses did that amount to? Can you put a number in terms of how much black farmers might have lost as a result of discrimination from the USDA?
Well, we know that they lost somewhere around 90% of their farmland. And in terms of a dollar figure, we can guess around, you know, billions of dollars of wealth was lost, and some might even say more than that. But advocates for black farmers argue that it wasn't just African-American farmers who were deprived, but their families, and that the racial wealth gap we see today between African-Americans and white Americans is directly related to this massive loss to farmland from the early 20th century to today.
Nadra, in the last segment, we referenced Pigford versus Glickman. This was a class action lawsuit brought against the USDA by black farmers, accusing the department of discriminating against black farmers who sought loans in the 80s and 90s. What were the plaintiffs alleging, and what was the final result of that suit?
So the plaintiffs were alleging that they faced overt racism, meaning that they would go in to apply for a loan and their loans would be thrown in the trash. John Boy Jr., the head of the National Black Farmers Association, said that when he went in seeking assistance from the USDA, he was actually spat on by an official there. So we're talking about pretty in-your-face racism. You know, if you're black, you need not apply.
Yeah, and then what came of the suit?
So in the late 1990s, in 1997, there was a settlement paid to Black farmers for a little over $1 billion. And then during the Obama administration, there was another settlement paid, widely known as Pigford II, that gave farmers another $1.25 billion. But broken down by all of the farmers who were affected, there wasn't much money to each individual farmer. So we're talking, you know, in the thousands of dollars, which didn't compensate for the generations of discrimination.
In your recent article in Eater, which was an incredible deep dive into this issue, you reported that white landowners possess 98% of all farmland in this country. The portion of the stimulus that just passed Congress that's directed at disadvantaged farmers should help Black farmers buy more land, right? I mean, do you expect that number to maybe go down and Black farmers could, because of this bill, get a larger piece of farmland in this country?
Well, because of this bill, what the National Black Farmers Association is hoping is that there will be fewer foreclosures. So Black farmers who own their land now should have an easier time being able to hang on to it. And this part of the stimulus bill should also open up more credit for Black farmers, allowing them to possibly buy more land. But I think we would need the passage of Cory Booker's Justice for Black Farmers Act to really help Black farmers acquire more farmland, especially those, you know, who do not currently own farmland today. That legislation from Booker has some provisions that would make it much easier for Black farmers to get farmland.
That would allow people who aren't in agriculture now to get into that business and to start buying land and cultivating crops?
Yes, that's the plan.
What's life like for Black farmers today? Can you characterize it before I let you go? We got just a few seconds left.
So today, you know, Black farmers own much less land than their white counterparts, but there is renewed interest from young Black farmers to owning land, growing their own food, and doing that as an act of resistance.
Nadra Niddle is a senior reporter for Civil Eats. She's also a contributor to Eater, where her recent story on Black farmers gave me personally an education on a world I knew little about. Nadra, thank you so much for coming on The Takeaway. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
On Wednesday, Des Moines Register reporter Andrea Sahori was acquitted of all charges following her arrest at last summer's protests for racial justice.
Immediately, I see this officer coming at me and I put up my hands and say, I'm press. He grabbed me, pepper sprayed me, and as he was doing so, said, that's not what I asked.
That was the Iowa journalist testifying at her trial on Tuesday, where she was being charged with failure to disperse and interference with official acts. Sahori was just one of several journalists who were facing charges connected to last summer's protests, which saw an unprecedented number of journalists arrested or detained for doing their jobs. Here to walk us through all of that is Kirsten McCudden, managing editor of the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. Kirsten, thanks for joining us.
Matt, thanks for having me on to talk about this.
Yeah, it's so important and very interesting case. Andrea Sahori was acquitted by jury in Iowa just yesterday. Why does this matter for both journalists and also the public?
It's a great question, Matt. A lot of eyes have been on Ms. Sahori's case because it's rare for a journalist to face trial. At the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, we document these things. And the last journalist we had going to trial was in 2018. So last summer, we saw, as you said, an unprecedented amount of journalists arrested or detained while covering Black Lives Matter protests, social justice protests all across the U.S., nearly 130, which, let's just put that in a little bit of context. In 2019, the tracker documented 9 journalists arrested or detained. So 2020, more than 125. But of those, most of the time, the journalist is released or the charges are dropped. In Ms. Zahori's case, it went all the way to trial. The charges of failure to disperse and interference with official acts were never dropped. And in fact, they took her to trial. It was a 3-day trial. And as you said, it ended yesterday with an acquittal on both counts.
And what was the state arguing? What were they saying that Zahori did?
So failure to disperse, that there was a dispersal order and that she did not do that, and also that she interfered. So interference with official acts, that means in this case it was that she sort of resisted arrest when the officer was putting her into cuffs. So the prosecution argued that her role as a journalist didn't matter, that she didn't have a right to be there. The defense argued that the dispersal order wasn't clear where they were, and that as a journalist, she has a right to be there to document.
What do we know about attitudes about the press in Iowa? Was this a Iowa-specific situation? I mean, I've reported in Iowa that people were always quite kind, never had an issue. I'm wondering, though, if there was a certain distrust of journalists there, similar to what we saw from the Trump administration, that might have been at play.
The prosecution wasn't very forthcoming from the May 31st arrest through the end of the trial about why this case in particular, about why Ms. Zahori, they wanted to take her through trial. And they said, all we have is speculation because all that was said from the DA was it will come out in trial. And turns out the jury very quickly acquitted her on both counts.
Kirsten, Zahori is just one of several reporters that you mentioned that will be on trial this year. What are some of the other notable cases that we should be looking out for?
Well, we hope that nobody else goes to trial. There are about a dozen, actually, journalists who are still facing charges from covering protests last summer. So those 12 journalists, they're in the hearing stages. So right now there are no other trials set, but we know one good example is a freelance reporter. Richard Cummings is his name. And this week he also had a hearing. And originally he had 3 charges against him. 2 of those have been dropped, but the failure to disperse, again, the same one that you heard with Andrea Zahori's trial, failure to disperse has still not been dropped against Richard Cummings. In fact, at his March 8th hearing, they just pushed it to April 20th. So he was arrested June 1st, one day after Ms. Zahori, who was May 31st, still facing charges, not yet dropped. And he'll be waiting till April 20th to find out what happens with those. That's one case that we're following. But at the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, we document all these cases and follow them through. So we'll follow them through until we know whether or not the charges have been dropped or, as you said, they may go to trial.
You know, Kirsten, I'm trying to think of this from law enforcement's perspective for a moment. It just must be becoming harder and harder for police to distinguish in the fog of war during a protest, let's say, between who are journalists documenting protests and who are protesters documenting protests, right? I mean, everyone is filming. It's now like reporters with fedoras on the side with press cards and like it maybe used to be. There's a whole new range of news outlets. And then from my experience, there's this antiquated, uneven way that states and cities and police approve reporters for press credentials. And then some reporters don't even wear press credentials because they feel like they can be targeted by some protesters because of that. Are there better ways to identify press in such circumstances so real reporters documenting history are not locked up like this?
You know, that came up at the trial as well, that Andrea Zahori wasn't wearing visible press credentials. And it comes down to each newsroom and each journalist, how safe they feel wearing credentials while, as you said, in the fog of war, while documenting, we know that protests have traditionally been dangerous place for journalists. The old lantern around the neck that says press mm-hmm. can't be used to yank somebody back. So it's really up to each newsroom, and like I said, each journalist to determine how safe they feel. Some of the recommendations are to have press pass or press credentials on you, but maybe not either taped to your body or a place where you can get to them. Those are some recommendations coming out of our partner network. And we saw it even through after the protests last summer, as we headed into November, the general election, very tense in America, that different newsrooms were talking with their journalists and saying, you know, this is how we want to prepare you. Some of them said, you know, we're taking riot gear. We have our journalists in helmets and protective vests. And then other outlets will say, well, we want you to show press. And others will say, I really don't feel safe. I'm going to have it on me, but undercover, just either coming from law enforcement or individuals just for safety. And also, as you said, journalism itself, I love the fedora, little feather, saying I'm press. Right. That has changed, and it's changed for the most part for the better. We have the ability to disseminate news wider and quicker, and that's not always recognized with the antiquated system of press passes.
Kirsten McCudden is the managing editor of the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. We'll be following these stories. Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Earlier this year, the television series It's a Sin broke streaming records in Britain. The show follows a group of queer characters in the 80s and early 90s during the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in London. Here's a scene from the show featuring actors Homi Miura and Ali Alexander.
I've had a look, and the result seems to be definite. I'm sorry to say you've passed the threshold into a diagnosis of AIDS. Do you know what that means?
Yes. I do.
Okay. We've got quite a few ways of approaching this, and we're getting new information all the time. I think we can start...
That's all right. I live in a house full of experts. That's all we talk about all day long.
It's a Sin premiered in the US on HBO Max in February, and while it hasn't made quite as big of a splash here as it did across the pond, it still managed to kickstart a range of conversations regarding LGBTQ representation in the entertainment industry today. Here with me now to discuss this is Naveen Kumar, a culture critic and journalist whose work has appeared in Them, The Daily Beast, and The Hollywood Reporter. Naveen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And we're also joined by Susanna Walters, director of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at Northeastern University and the author of numerous books, including The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thank you. Naveen, let's start with you. What stood out to you about It's a Sin and how it depicted the AIDS crisis?
What's unique about It's a Sin is, you know, it has a joyful, vibrant tone that we haven't really seen in previous works about this period. You know, when we think about work that was made, you know, earlier, closer to the height of the crisis, like The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer, or, you know, the movie Philadelphia, there was this urgent need to really, you know, get the culture to pay attention to the devastation and the loss. You know, look, these people are dying. This is what we're going through, and we need help. You know, now, some 30 years later, a show like It's a Sin can go back and focus, you know, on how young everyone was and how much fun they hope to have in their lives when AIDS really blindsided them like this.
Susanna, in terms of that question of queer community, how do you think the show represents the friendships and the community that many gay people have?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think one of the things that struck me about this show was the vibrancy of the queer community and the pleasures of queer life. And, you know, one of the things that was so great about it, too, is that it showed community, because we rarely see that. We so much the history of gay representation has been sort of the token gay, you know, the queer gay in a sea of heterosexual life. And so one of the things I loved about watching this was both the depiction of queer community and queer pleasure and queer sexuality, and also a real focus on the ways in which straight culture and the state, certainly in governments, both demonized the victims of HIV/AIDS and neglected them. And so you get both in this, which I think is really rare.
Susanna, what about the gender divide that you observed with It's a Sin? What were some of your critiques of the show in that regard?
Well, as much as I loved it, I couldn't help but be irritated at the way in which women were depicted. So there's really one major female character, and she is the prototypical fag hag. You know, she lives for the men, for the boys. She helps them. She aids them. She offers them support and love and seems to have no needs or desires of her own. So she's sort of there as a, you know, a support to the men. In addition, of course, what's invisible is the vibrant lesbian support that was really a part of AIDS support communities from the very beginning. I mean, both straight women and lesbians were integral to the kinds of support networks in New York, in London, everywhere, without which sufferers would have been much more alone.
Naveen, how do you think It's a Sin does when it comes to depicting queer characters of color?
I agree with Susanna about the Lydia West character. You know, she's really, as joyful as it was to see someone, you know, be so generous with their attention, it was, you know, pretty clear she was kind of a totem. But, you know, she's, you know, an actress of color. Omari Douglas and Nathaniel Curtis are also in the supporting ensemble. You know, it's still led by a white protagonist. You know, Ollie Alexander, who we heard in the clip, is a, you know, sort of pop singer of some fame in the UK. And, you know, I think there's sort of admirable effort to surround him with a more diverse supporting cast. You know, I wouldn't say, in terms of looking at, if we think about who's really struggling with the crisis now, you know, it's really Black men and trans women of color. So, you know, I think there could have been, would have wished to see, especially, you know, some nod to trans experience with this crisis as well, especially since it's still so ongoing in those communities.
Right. Sure. Naveen, I'm curious why It's a Sin has yet to resonate here as much as it has in the UK. Do you have a sense of that, particularly why it's resonated so much in the UK with younger audience, but hasn't really taken hold here yet?
Well, I think, you know, Russell T Davies, the creator, has a profile in the UK as a television creator. You know, I think there's attention that's sort of paid to his work. You know, and in Britain, it was a television event. You know, it was on BBC week to week, and it really, you know, everyone's at home. It was more of like event television. Here, you know, wisely or not, they dropped it as a binge, so it was all out at once. You know, and just with everything there is to see and watch at home right now, I think, you know, it can be tough to break through. I think, you know, it being based in London and, you know, sort of the specifics of that and you know, people over there, I can see them, you know, sort of latching onto it more easily.
Sure, that makes sense. And plus, there is a ton of content to wade through, so sometimes it, you know, it's not the fault of the show itself if it doesn't break through the cloud, so to speak. Naveen, earlier this year, the movie Supernova came out, and it stars Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci, who are both straight in real life, and they play a gay couple. Here's Tucci on CBS responding to the question of whether only gay actors should play gay characters.
I have difficulty with that. I think that acting is all about not being yourself. If we were to use that as a template, then we would only ever play ourselves. I think what we need to do, we need to give more gay actors opportunities. People who are gay have only recently, in the last few years really, have been able to say, I'm gay and I'm an actor. And I can play straight roles and I can play, they always had to hide their sexuality so that they could play the leading man or the leading woman.
Naveen, what do you make of Stanley Tucci's comment there?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Stanley Tucci, and I understand what he's saying. I think a lot of actors have this idea that, you know, playing a character means, playing someone outside yourself. And I agree, that it's about, furthering Hollywood's acceptance of openly queer actors, or, you know, sort of making it a more welcome landscape for those actors to come out. You know, I think the problem is sort of a business one, you know, with straight actors playing these roles. You know, the reason, you know, if you look at a movie like Supernova, Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth, you know, they're bankable stars, you know, in this sort of indie landscape. So, you know, they help, their attachment to the project help gets the movie made, you know, so then, you know, people will go and see it. But the idea is we need, you know, to make a more welcoming atmosphere for queer actors to, you know, develop careers like this and be able to say, you know, look, these actors also, you know, you can take them to the bank.
Right. Susanna, what are your thoughts on straight actors playing gay roles?
Oh, God, it's a tough one. I mean, you know, I hear what Tucci's saying and I don't disagree. I guess I would say, let's wait, you know, 20 years from now. We need more equity before we can get to that place. We right. need to have reached a place where the closet and gay actors not having to hide their identity is a thing, really a thing of the past. And for all of the fantasies that were there, we're not there yet. So I loved that film, and as wonderful as the two of them are, you know, I do feel like it becomes a win-win for straight actors and a lose-lose for gay actors. And, you know, there's a way in which, it is premised on a fantasy, I think, that everyone can be out and no one's going to be hurt by being openly gay. So that, you know, therefore it's just an acting job, and it just is not the case. And I think the business question that Naveen raised is part of it, but I think the reality of the Hollywood closet continuing is also a part of it.
Well, what did it used to be like? Let's look back at the past for a moment. How were queer people represented in media a few decades ago, Susanna?
Oh, God. I mean, for most of the history of popular representation, you know, gays were either invisible or abject, you know, sites of abjection, sites of mockery, stereotypes, abjection. They were the killer queers from hell. They were FBI agents, you know, turncoats. They were spies, monsters, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, you know, the great history of representation is a history of either abjection or invisibility. You know, then we get to this sort of moment of explosion of visibility that starts really in the 80s, but I guess reaches its sort of signal moment with the coming out of Ellen in 97, which really, I think, signals a shift in popular representation. And, you know, then we begin to get this sort of trickle of representation, which becomes a flood. And we get to the moment we are now. And I do think we've moved from the sort of token moments that we had with the Ellen moment, where that's, you know, this dramatic coming out, the single character, to more integrated characters, characters in television in particular, but some in film as well, where their gayness is not invisible, not abject, but also not everything they are. And that seems to me a really critical moment when you have a robust integration of queers into popular culture narratives. I think that's a key moment. I think the other key moment, and this is to get back to It's a Sin, what's so important about that, another key moment is where gays are not the only one, and that they're not only in relation to heterosexual culture. So I do think it's a vital, I mean, for me, always looking at, you know, what's a good representation? It's a good representation, at least in part, when you begin to see queers not only in relation to straight people, that queers right. have queer friends, they have queer communities, they have queer families, that we're not only understood in relation to how we do or do not make heterosexuals anxious.
Yeah, it moves away from the tokenism. That's interesting. Naveen, what have you noticed in terms of changes in LGBT representation in media recently?
Yeah, I agree with Susanna. I mean, I think, you know, the big development lately has been, you know, we're moving away, it feels like, from looking at LGBTQ plus people as a subculture, you know, rather than as an integral part of a broader world. So, you know, so many series about young people have central queer characters. You know, look at Euphoria on HBO, which Zendaya won the Emmy for, and Generation, which actually premieres today on HBO as well. You know, they have, as a matter of course, I think it, you know, they have queer characters in leading roles. I think there's a sense that to reach young audiences, you know, they want to see worlds on screen that are inclusive and, you know, explore gender and sexuality in a more expansive, you know, fluid way that really reflects, you know, these sort of developing ideas about identity that they, you know, that they bring to everything they watch.
Naveen, you mentioned a show that's coming out this week. What's that called?
Generation premieres on HBO tonight. It's a Lena Dunham produced series, another one of these sort of edgy high school, you know, dramas, and there are central queer characters in that as well.
And do you see that might signal some improvement in terms of the representation, queer representation on the screen?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, every one of these series that, you know, we get everything from prestige dramas like, you know, Euphoria to, you know, something like Love, Victor. You know, we want to have a broader range of, you know, representation so that, you know, one single series doesn't have to stand in for, you know, the whole queer experience, quote unquote.
Naveen Kumar is a culture critic and journalist, and Susanna Walters is the director of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at Northeastern University. I can't wait to watch some of these shows. Thanks so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
That's your Thursday Takeaway. Been good being with you today. Quick shout out to Ruben Katz, who is starting his hopefully stellar education career today. His first in-person day of kindergarten was this morning, and I was lucky enough to be able to see him off. Good luck, bud. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And I'm at MattKatz00. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.